Today at Reader's Corner, former Oklahoma Congressman Mickey Edwards, author of The Parties Versus the People, How to Turn Republicans and Democrats into Americans.
As party becomes the dominant consideration and the party ideological agenda becomes the dominant consideration, the ability to have a workable, separated powers kind of government is just diminished. Talk, media, radio, and television rile up their base, and that again puts pressure on people not to compromise. I think we're at the beginning of a revolution. I'm actually not pessimistic because I think things got so bad that people are beginning to demand change.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Fans of novels depicting dystopian societies need look no further than our nation's Congress for real-life examples of governance run amok. That's the message from today's guest, former U.S. Representative Mickey Edwards, author of The Parties Versus the People, How to Turn Republicans and Democrats into Americans. Mr. Edwards argues that blind allegiance to party affiliation has turned lawmakers into followers rather than leaders, with many voting their party line more than 90% of the time. Rigid adherence to Republican or Democratic positions, he writes, is undermining compromise and effectively gridlocking the democratic process. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Mickey Edwards. I first spoke with him last spring as the 2014 primary elections were getting underway around the country. Since then, our political landscape has changed some, with the Republicans gaining control of the U.S. Senate in the November general election. But Mr. Edwards' perspective and insights, as outlined in his book, remain relevant. Mickey Edwards was a Republican member of Congress from Oklahoma for 16 years. Since leaving Congress in 1993, he has taught at Harvard, Georgetown, and Princeton universities, and the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and he now runs a political leadership program for elected officials as vice president of the Aspen Institute. Mr. Edwards is co-founder of the group No Labels, a citizens' movement of Democrats, Republicans, and Independents dedicated to a new politics of problem solving. Mr. Edwards joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. for this interview. Mickey Edwards, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be on it.
Well, Mickey, tell us about your own career in government. You ran for Congress from Oklahoma. What was that district like? What were the times like? How long did you stay? Well, we know that was 16 years, but give us a little rundown.
You know, Bob, it was very, very different from the way it is today. When I ran, and I'm a Republican, the seat I ran for, 5th District in Oklahoma, which is basically Oklahoma City, had not elected a Republican since 1928. And then the district itself was about 74% Democrat. And so, you know, it was one of those really dumb campaigns, but I managed to win it and got to go to Congress. But, you know, it was a time when you got there, and I was the only Republican in the congressional delegation from Oklahoma when I got there. And yet we worked together. All the others were Democrats. There were 6 of us at the time, 5 Democrats and me. And you know, we worked together because we saw each other, even though we ran on Democratic or Republican labels and had differences of opinion. We saw ourselves collectively as the representatives of Oklahoma and the people in Oklahoma. And so we worked on, if somebody had a project in his district, I would try to help. They would try to help me. We put together a group of us from the House delegation and the Senate delegation to work on economic development. And even though I was the only Republican, I was the one who was named the chair of that working group. And so it was a different time. It was you ran on a party ticket and you supported your principles, but you saw the other person as a fellow member of Congress, you know, as somebody whose views you might not agree with, but you could respect. And, you know, it's a time that we got things done.
Well, you cite all kinds of examples in your book of bipartisan support, Eisenhower's interstate system, Johnson's Civil Rights Act, Medicare, the National Environmental Policy Act. I was interviewing somebody about Earth Day last week, and we pointed out that it was Nixon that proposed the EPA. Judicial appointees, what's changed to make it so impossible now to get folks to work together? And I think the thing that really grinds on me more than any of them, because with so many of these issues, you can see conservative and liberal ideology getting in the way of the party's ability to act. But let's just take appointees to the administration. In a good number of cases I've read about, it's not even as though there is an ideological objection. It's just slowing down the machinery of government. In your face, Mr. President. That seems to me to be a relatively new phenomenon in the U.S. government.
Well, it is, but there are several different things that have all come together to bring us to this point. You know, one of them, and one I focus on in my book, is systemic, and that is we have in 46 states what we call sore loser laws, which means that if you don't win your party's primary, no matter how popular you are in the state and no matter how few people voted in the primary, you know, you're not, if you don't win that primary or that party convention, even if there were a small number of people there, you can't be on the ballot in November. So we narrow the choices for the voters, and those choices then of who's going to be on the ballot are made by the people who participate in the primaries, who show up at the conventions, and who are mostly the more partisan and more ideological members of the party. So that's one of the things that has caused this division, because in order to keep those people who are the most partisan happy and avoid getting challenged in a party primary, you have to kind of take a hard line and not compromise. But there were at least two other factors. One of them is that people who were more hardline realized that they didn't have to actually win a general election. So if you have a state like Texas, which is a one-party Republican state, or you have a state like Massachusetts, which is a one-party Democratic state, you know, if you can win the primary, you've got it knocked. You know, this is how Ted Cruz got elected in Texas, because he was able, with a relatively small number of votes in a state of 26 million people, to win a primary. And then, of course, being the Republican nominee, you know, he was going to go on to get elected. So the use of the party primary system and convention system, which is relatively recent. Jacob Javits and Clifford Case, two Republican U.S. senators, were knocked off a long time ago, in the 70s, I think, in primaries. But that was uncommon. Now it's pretty common to get challenged from within your party in a primary. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I point to is the ascendancy in the House of Newt Gingrich, who, as he became the whip, the party whip, and then the speaker, he changed the dynamic. His strategy was nonstop partisan warfare, where to get a committee assignment or a committee chairmanship especially, you had to be the person who was most willing to follow the party leadership, to raise money for the party, to do battle against, you know, the Democrats. And so that put a little poison into the well. And then I guess maybe there's a final thing, and that is the rise of talk media, radio and television. And so you're an outlier here. You know, most of the people who do shows are people who, you know, draw very hard lines in the sand. They usually don't know what they're talking about, but they rile up their base. And that, again, puts pressure on people not to compromise.
Well, let's go back to the party primary. The problem there, and of course, for our listeners who may not realize this, the party primary came into existence as a result of a reaction to party bosses who were making these decisions. And so it's like, well, we're going to democratize this. We're going to let the average voter play a role. So we'll put the primary election into play here. And I think it was the progressive movement that had some responsibility for that. But frankly, Mickey, if you turn this thing back over to the party bosses of today anyway, back then it seemed they were most interested in who could get elected in the general. But the party bosses today, to your point a little earlier, seem more interested in just making sure that their ideology reigns supreme and we'll worry about the general election later.
I think that's largely true. I certainly don't want to go back to the party bosses in smoking cigars in a closed room. but the people, the progressive movement, which came up with the idea of party primaries, did not envision that they would be these closed party primaries dominated by a few. So they just basically changed. They made the small group bigger, but it's still not, as big as it ought to be for the electorate as a whole. But I think that, one of the things that I have seen happen is that even the party leaders themselves inside the Congress, take for example, are afraid to challenge the grassroots now who participated in the primaries. And the best example is Mitch McConnell in the Senate, who is, the Senate Republican leader, and he's fighting for his political survival, being challenged in a primary in his own party, and it's a very close race. John Boehner and other Republican leaders in the House have also been, threatened from their partisans. And so people have said, I know you've been teaching, and political scientists will always claim that party leaders are not as strong as they used to be. It's that the party leaders now are the grassroots members of the caucus, who came in. So it's not right. John Boehner who, is forced into positions by his own members instead of the other way around. But they're responding to the hardcore base. And I should also point out, this is not entirely a Republican thing. When I was in Congress, there were a lot of conservative Democrats. They called them boll weevils or blue dogs or different things. But a lot of conservative Democrats in Congress, and they're pretty well gone now too. There are, very small number. So the parties, because of all of this system, have divided. Where the Republican Party in elective office is far more to the right than it used to be, and more ideological and hardline, and the Democratic Party is far more to the left than it used to be, and more ideological and hardline. It's not just a fault of one party; it's the system itself.
Let's go back and talk about that primary, the closed primary. You mentioned closed, and for our listeners who may not know the mechanics of party primaries, there was a time, I know, when I taught political science back in the 90s, it was obvious that there were many states that had open primaries and there were a number of states that had closed. But that's all changed. So help our listeners understand the difference between those two and what has happened to the primary, especially as it moves towards this closed approach.
Yeah, let me change the terminology a little bit, because very few states have open primaries. What a lot of states do have is a primary where you can choose when you go to the polls to vote in either the Republican Party or the Democratic primary, but you can only vote in one, and so it's still the people who participated are going to determine the Republican nominee in one primary and the Democratic in the other, and whoever doesn't win those primaries is off the ballot in the fall. So the open primary, that's the common terminology. I really think of it more as a general election with a runoff. And the best two examples are in Washington State and in California, which have both recently adopted that system, California in 2010. And what they do there is that every candidate who is qualified to run under the state laws, whatever they are, every candidate who's qualified runs on the same ballot. So you will have a ballot that has every Republican, every Democrat, every independent, green, libertarian, whatever, who is qualified to run on that ballot. And every single voter in that state is entitled to choose among all those options. You vote in that one race. And then if nobody gets over 50%, you then have a runoff between the top two, even if they're of the same party. Well, what that means is that because everybody is voting, you're getting a reflection of what all the people in the state want. You would get a reflection of what all the people in Idaho want, because in that one race, everybody can choose among all of the available options. I don't know whether it would make the outcome more liberal or more conservative. It depends on the district or the state, but what it would do is be a more accurate reflection of the entire electorate. So it may not be the perfect solution, but it really breaks the back of the non-compromisers. And let me say, somehow we got this idea that compromise is a bad word. You know, I was national chairman of the American Conservative Union. I was one of the three founders of the Heritage Foundation. I'm a conservative. But when you go to the polls and are appealing to the electorate, it's a very diverse electorate. There are 300 million Americans, and we can't do anything. We can't do the legitimate functions of government if we can't sit down with somebody who has a different point of view and say, okay, let's find an area of common ground so that we can keep the water safe, keep the pharmaceuticals safe, you know, keep the bridges repaired. The government has jobs to do. And if we're going to fight over everything all the time and can't fill the point of offices, you know, we can't function as a government. And our system is one of self-government. And what that means is that the people get to choose, and then the ones they choose, you know, run the government. Well, we've stopped running the government. We basically said, you know, we don't want to agree with somebody who has a different point of view ever, mm-hmm. or we're going to get knocked off in a primary.
You're listening to former Congressman Mickey Edwards. He's the author of the book, The Parties Versus the People, How to Turn Republicans and Democrats into Americans, and that is exactly what we're talking about here today. You know, Mickey, when it comes to this idea of unwilling to compromise, there's no doubt that we see that every day in the news, and we hear all kinds of stories about it. And it just seems to me that the unwillingness to compromise has a lot more consequences for members of one party right now than it has for the other. And that could be my, just because I live in Idaho, where I'm in a state that is about 75-80% Republican in the state legislature. All of our congressional office holders are Republican. It's really a one-party state. But I ask you, because you do have such good conservative credentials, is the penalty for straying from the party line, if you are a member of Congress and you want to reach across the aisle and help another congressman with a particular bill or vote a way that isn't the party line, is the penalty for straying from the party line on the Republican side the same as on the Democrat side? It just seems to me like with the Tea Party so active, it's far greater penalty for Republicans to stray from the party line these days than it is for Democrats. I mean, I think you mentioned the Occupy movement in your book, but I certainly don't think I'd put the Occupy movement alongside the Tea Party in terms of the power they have at the ballot box these days.
No, I think that the movement to use the primary system and the convention system to weed out candidates who are unacceptable to the hardliners is more pronounced on the Republican side. I think that's true. But it's not exclusive. This was a few years ago, but Joe Lieberman, who had been state attorney general, he'd been, the U.S. Senator, had been his party's nominee for vice president, you know, was defeated in a primary in Connecticut, you know, by his fellow Democrats. Connecticut is one of the four states that doesn't have a sore loser law, and so he was able to still be on the ballot in November, where he won. So you do see, I think, a greater impetus on the Republican side to use the primaries to knock people off, and much more developed. And so, no, I think that's true. But inside the Congress, you have the same kind of ideological bias in both parties. For example, when you see a vote where all the Republicans are on one side and all the Democrats on the other side, the public attention is on the fact that the Republicans wouldn't compromise. Well, the Democrats don't either. they all stick together. And Harry Reid in the Senate has gotten very bad about preventing amendments even from being brought to the floor, you know, or bills being brought to the floor, you know, that go against his own party line agenda. And so I think in the primaries and the conventions, it's probably a more developed problem on the Republican side, but I don't think it's exclusively a Republican problem.
One of the things I saw on both sides of the aisle when I served in the state legislature was the development of these committees, these partisan committees on each side of the aisle that would raise significant funds, that would go out and identify candidates they wanted to run for office, they would eliminate other candidates by doing so. It was anything but an open system. It was the party leaders in the legislature dictating to local legislative districts who their next representative would be based on what was best for the party. And you talk about some of this in your book to the extent that the Congress these days is really more about party leaders than government leaders. You mentioned Newt Gingrich. He may be the guy that that kicked off this in Congress. I don't know when it started or how slow the development, but it sure seems to me like things have changed when it comes to a focus on party politics instead of a focus on governing.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I do think it started with Gingrich, who was kind of a disaster so far as our constitutional system of government is concerned. But, you know, in fairness, he was elected to be the Republican whip out of reaction to the fact that the Democrat Jim Wright, when he was Speaker, you know, was preventing Republicans from bringing amendments to the floor. And so Republicans who wanted to participate in governing, you know, said, well, let's find the biggest bomb thrower we can find. And they turned to Newt. But, you know, your friend and mine, Denny Hastert, did the same thing when he became Speaker of the House. And he said, well, he's only going to bring things to the floor that the majority of his own party wanted. So it has been a problem that has grown with impetus from both sides. As we mentioned, you know, before, you know, Harry Reid in the Senate, Democrat, is keeps Republicans from getting a voice with amendments or bills. And part of that is because whether it's Harry or Nancy Pelosi or Mitch McConnell or you know, to a lesser extent, John Boehner, these people now function as party leaders. That's why when Mitch McConnell was asked what his goal was as the Republican leader in the Senate, he said, well, it's to defeat Barack Obama. And when Nancy Pelosi, Democrat, was asked when she became Speaker of the House, you know, what's her goal? It was to elect more Democrats. And so, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. One of the things I proposed in my book is to change the system where, number one, you could have a secret ballot for Speaker. Number two, you could have something like the system in Great Britain where in order to be elected Speaker, you have to have nominations from members of more than one party. I think it's either a third or a fourth of the nominations for Speaker of the House of Commons have to come from a member of the other party. So there are ways to change that and turn our speakers and our majority leaders in the Senate and minority leaders in both cases, turn them into people whose job is to make the system work, to operate the legislative branch of government rather than just being spokesmen for their own party agendas.
You have a chapter in your book on the partisan presidency, so it's not just about Congress. You also comment on the nature of the presidency today and how that's changed. Help us understand that.
Well, it has changed a great deal. And the current presidency is a good example. It used to be fairly common for presidents to reach out, understanding that they had to have, number one, they had sometimes to have the support of people from the other party for their positions to prevail. But number two, even if they could prevail, they wanted to have as much buy-in by the public as possible. And one of the people who has been so misconstrued is Lyndon Johnson. I had a reporter call me not long ago and was talking about LBJ's strong-arm leadership and how he was able to intimidate people into supporting him. And I said, well, you've got him all wrong. You know, the thing was that Lyndon Johnson knew the system and he knew how to talk to members. He knew what they were looking for. You know, he knew how to shape things so that he could get support from across the aisle. That's been lost. And the presidency today, whether it's the current president or the one before him, they tend to play into this game of it's not about how can we bring people together to support a policy. that we think is the right thing? How can we sit down and figure out what compromises you have to make to get people on board? You know, now it's, they're the cheerleaders for how evil and awful the people on the other side are. I mean, Barack Obama does this all the time. It's not that Republicans, in his view, are principled opponents who have a different point of view, but they are, you know, terrible people who don't care whether somebody gets sick and dies. I mean, so this is true now in both sides, and one of the things that's happened that is quite bad, playing a little bit off of your question, it's not the same point, but one of the fundamentals about the American form of government is the separation of powers. And that envisions most of the power of the federal government being in the Congress, and the Congress doing active oversight and checking the executive branch. Well, when you look at everything through a partisan lens and you see the president as not the head of another branch of government over which you're supposed to exercise restraint and oversight, but rather as your team leader, your party leader, you know, it really breaks down the separation of power. So times when George W. Bush did things that were clearly, in my view, unconstitutional, that Republicans in the past would have stood up and protested against, Republicans now just supported him, defended him, because he was their guy. And I have examples of that in the book. The same thing happens now when Barack Obama does something which is unconstitutional, which is an expansion of presidential authority beyond what's permissible. You know, his party stands with him. And, you know, it's a long cry from when Harry Truman was in the Senate and he conducted investigation into FDR's, you know, Defense Department, or, you know, War Department as it was. And so we've kind of lost this as party becomes the dominant consideration and the party ideological agenda becomes the dominant consideration. The ability to have a workable, separated powers kind of government is just diminished.
Well, is there any improvement or hope out there? You wrote this book. The publishing date is 2012. You probably wrote it then in 2011. It's 14 now. Have you been able to get any converts? I also want to talk about the No Labels organization, because that's a very good way to deal with this challenge we face. But are there any congressmen or senators who are stepping up and becoming more vocal about this need to reach out across the aisle and form coalitions, the likes of which ran this country for many generations?
The two people who are currently the voice of No Labels, they weren't among the founders, but they've become the leaders, at least the public face, are Senator Joe Manchin, who's a Democrat from West Virginia, right, and former Governor John Huntsman, who are leading this. But actually, you know, there's, I don't know what the exact number is now, but it's over 100, I think, members of Congress have signed on to No Labels to sit and meet together once a week and talking about ways that they can cooperate. I quoted in my book, USA Today, you know, writing an article about the fact that the people are fleeing from the political parties. In Massachusetts today, there are more voters who are independents than there are either Republicans or Democrats. 40% of the American electorate today registers as independents. So, yeah, actually, in my speeches, I say that the revolution is beginning. Whether you see it in No Labels or you see it in how people register, or whether you see it in the polls that show so much unhappiness with the way government is and people wanting to not participate anymore, I think people have had it. And that's why in Washington State in 2006, California in 2010, when they passed these changes to reduce the power of the parties through primaries and redistricting, the party leaders in both parties fought bitterly against those changes. But the public said, you know, the people themselves went to the polls and said, we don't care how you feel. We're tired of this. We want change. There are a number of other states now where these changes are being introduced and being considered. So I think we're at the beginning of a revolution. I'm actually not pessimistic, because I think things got so bad that people are beginning to demand change.
Well, after I read your book, I went on to No Labels and I joined the revolution, I guess.
There's actually
a place where you can sign up and get emails from the organization, and I would urge our listeners, if they're interested, that's nolabels.com. Well, I tell you, this has been a great interview. I really appreciate your time. I've enjoyed your comments. Again, I encourage our listeners to get a copy of the book. It's The Parties Versus the People, How to Turn Republicans and Democrats into Americans. Mickey, I really appreciate you joining us today.
Good to talk to you.
Same here. Thank you. I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Mickey Edwards. Next week, prize-winning author and Boise resident Anthony Doerr talking about his novel, All the Light We Cannot See. The engineer for today's show is Adam Cotterell. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.